This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a recorded lecture with disability activist Judy Heumann, known as the mother of the disability rights movement and who served in the Obama administration as the special advisor on international disability rights. But first, disability news for the week of December 23rd, 2024. In what is the first study of its kind, researchers looked at the results of eliminating subminimum wages for people with disabilities in two states. Under an 86-year-old law, employers can still apply for Section 14C certificates from the U.S. Department of Labor, allowing them to pay people with disabilities less than the federal minimum of $7.25 per hour. And because of that, some workers earn just pennies per hour. In recent years, disability advocates have argued that the model creates opportunities for exploitation and limits community engagement. In recent years, at least 15 states, including Illinois, have passed laws to phase out subminimum wage. This month, the U.S. Department of Labor proposed ending the program altogether. For the new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Health Forum, researchers looked at results in New Hampshire and Maryland who approved phase-outs of the program in 2015 and 16, respectively. Using the Census Bureau's American Community Survey between 2010 and 19, the study assessed how the experiences of people with cognitive disabilities changed when subminimum wage ended in their state. In fact, both states had increases in employment and labor force participation after the repeal of Section 14C, but to different degrees. The researcher said that New Hampshire had better results because they had bigger investments in integrated employment training for people with developmental disabilities following the repeal or other state-specific factors. The study also notes that Maryland's law caused a four-year phase-out of subminimum wage employment, but New Hampshire had no workers with disabilities earning less than minimum wage in 2015 when that state finally banned the practice. That New Hampshire saw leaps in labor force participation and employment suggests that the policy change alone can be meaningful. Mihir Kakara is the study's lead author and an assistant professor of neurology at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine. She said the findings show that the, quote, inclusive nature of repeal, as it brings people with cognitive disabilities previously not connected with employment resources into the labor force. This points toward the fact that these people are able to work in equal-paying, fully integrated jobs as their peers who do not have a disability, given the right resources, something that was perceived not to be the case when this law was first drafted, end quote. Even with the variations seen among states, the researchers said they did not reveal any negative effects on people with developmental disabilities, though they acknowledge that the possibilities for certain subpopulations could not be ruled out. Federal officials are finalizing a rule that they say will provide the biggest expansion of rights in the last 10 years for people with disabilities who fly. Under the regulation published last week, the U.S. Department of Transportation will require better training for airline staff and contractors who assist people with disabilities, as well as those who handle wheelchairs. Also, the rule increases the expectations for how help is provided and what must occur if a wheelchair is damaged or delayed. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg said, quote, every passenger deserves safe, dignified travel when they fly, and we've taken unprecedented actions to hold airlines accountable when they do not provide fair treatment to passengers with disabilities. With the new protection we're announcing today, we're establishing a new standard for air travel with clear and thorough guidelines for airlines to ensure that passengers using wheelchairs can travel safely and with dignity, end quote. quote. The rule says the airlines must provide safe and dignified assistance to passengers with disabilities that respect their independence, autonomy, and privacy. Airline staff and contractors who provide physical assistance to people with disabilities or who handle wheelchairs or scooters will be required to undergo annual training starting no later than June 17th of 2026. In addition, the rule requires that people with disabilities receive prompt assistance when getting on and off aircraft and making connections. Airline staff must be available to help those who use a boarding chair to deplane, and the passenger's personal wheelchair must be positioned as close as possible to the door of the plane, the rule states. The regulation also makes it a violation of the Air Carrier Access Act if airlines damage or delay the return of a wheelchair or another assistive device. Wheelchairs or scooters that are delayed must be returned to the passenger within 24 hours for domestic flights, according to the rule. If the person's wheelchair or scooter does not fit in the cargo hold on their flight, or if mobility devices are not loaded onto an individual's scheduled flight for any reason, airlines will be expected to rebook passengers with disabilities on the next available flight at no cost, the Transportation Department said. The rule also sets new standards for the design of onboard wheelchairs that will be phased in starting in October of 2026. The final rule will take effect January 16th, but some provisions will not be implemented immediately. And finally, in Aurora, Illinois last week, the police and the Secretary of State detail checked more than 100 cars using disability placards. Of the 100 cars checked, 15 were ticketed for misuse of the placard, and 9 placards were confiscated outright. The Illinois Secretary of State office reminds you during this time that a placard is for the convenience of the person for whom it is assigned. If the person with a disability is not present when the placard is used, it is a violation of the law. That means family members, friends, or anyone else looking for more convenient parking may be at risk for an expensive ticket if caught. And that's the news for this week. And to our listeners who celebrate, happy holidays. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. I told that girl that my prospects were good. She said, baby, it's understood. Working for peanuts is all very fine. But I can't show you.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and today we'll be listening to a lecture by one of the most important disability advocates that ever lived in this in recent years. After contracting polio, before she turned 2 years old, Judy Heumann used a wheelchair for most of her life. She and her family fought to be included in the public schools. For years, every summer, she attended Camp Jened, a camp for children with disabilities in New York, where she learned about the life experiences that she shared with other children with disabilities who ultimately all became very important advocates in our world. A recent documentary called Crip Camp features a young Judy Heumann as well as other important disability advocates. After many years as an advocate, Heumann served as Assistant Secretary of the Office of Special Education and Disability Services in the Clinton administration and was later appointed by President Obama as a Special Advisor on International Disability Rights for the U.S. State Department. Here is Judith Heumann.
I was born in 1947. A long time ago. And when I was 18 months old, I had polio. I was in an iron lung for 3 months and in and out of the hospital for 3 years. Now, we had lots of neighbors in our Brooklyn neighborhood, and some of them were really very helpful for my parents. Some of them were really afraid of contagion, and they wouldn't even walk in front of our house. They would literally walk across the street. I think this was a time when my family really began to realize what disability meant to some people, fear. And it wasn't even a sure thing that I would live at home, although I didn't learn about this till I was 36 years old. I was having a discussion with my father one night, and he said, you know, when you were 2 years old, one of the doctors suggested to your mom and I that you live in an institution, that they could just go ahead with their lives and raise their kids and kind of be done with having to deal with all the disability-related things. I didn't believe my father, not because he was a liar, but I had never heard this story. And my mother, in fact, validated that. She never wanted to tell me. But in reality, I don't know why I was really surprised by this story. Because when I was 5 years old, and my mother, like mothers and fathers all across the United States, was taking me to school to enroll, she pushed my wheelchair to the school in walking distance to our house, pulled the wheelchair up the steps into the school, and we were greeted by the principal. Not really greeted, but the principal said, no, I couldn't come to that school because it wasn't accessible. But he told us not to worry, because the Board of Education, in fact, would send a teacher to my house. And they did, for a total of 2.5 hours a week. But for good behavior, they threw in an occupational therapist who taught me that very essential skill of cross-stitching. I don't cross-stitch today. I didn't actually get to go to school in a real building until I was 9 years old. And then I was in classes only with disabled children in a school that had mainly non-disabled children. And in my classes, there were students up to the age of 21. And then after 21, they went to something called sheltered workshops with menial work and earning either nothing or below minimum wage. So I understood discrimination. My parents understood discrimination. My parents came from Germany. They were German Jews who left in the 1930s, escaping the Holocaust. My parents lost family, and they lost parents. Both my parents lost their parents in the Holocaust. And so they realized that they could not be silent as things were going wrong for me in my life. Not me personally, but what was going on around me. They learned that because I used a wheelchair, none of the high schools in New York City and the entire city were wheelchair accessible. So what was supposed to happen is I was supposed to go back onto home instruction along with many other students. So my parents banded together with other parents. They went to the Board of Education and they demanded that the Board of Ed make some of the high schools accessible. And they did. And so I and many others were finally able to go to high school, a regular high school, and take regular classes. So what happened next? I was learning more and more about what discrimination was, and equally important, I was learning that I needed to become my own advocate. I was entering college, Long Island University, and I had always wanted to be a teacher. And so I minored in education, and I took all the appropriate courses. And then when it was time for me to go for my license, I had to take a written exam, an oral exam, and a medical exam. At that time, all three of those exams were given in completely inaccessible buildings. So I had friends who carried me up and down the steps for these exams, not in a motorized wheelchair. In a manual wheelchair. But I passed my oral exam. I passed my written exam. My medical exam was something completely different. One of the first questions the doctor asked me was, could I please show her how I went to the bathroom? I was 22 years old. And you know, when you go for any kind of an interview, you think about all the kinds of questions people could ask you. That was not one of them. And I was like freaked out in the first place because I had heard that there were actually know disabled people using wheelchairs who had teachers in New York. So each step along the way, I was expecting something bad. So I said to her, is it a requirement that teachers show their students how to go to the bathroom? If it is, I can do that. So no surprise, I was failed because I didn't pass the medical. The official reason that I was denied my job was paralysis of poliomyelitis, sequelae of paralysis of both lower limbs, sequelae of poliomyelitis. Honestly, I didn't know what the word sequelae meant, so I went to the dictionary and it meant because of. So I'd been denied my license because I couldn't walk. So what was I going to do? This is a really important time in my life because it would be the first time that I really would be challenging the system, me. And although I was working with a lot of other friends who had disabilities who were encouraging me to move forward with this, it was nonetheless quite frightening. But I was really very lucky. I had a friend who was a disabled student at Long Island University and was also a stringer at the New York Times. And he was able to get a reporter to write a really good piece about what had happened and why he thought what had happened was wrong. The next day, there was an editorial in the New York Times with the title of Human versus the Board of Education. And the New York Times came out in support of my getting my teaching license. And then the same day, I got a call from an attorney who was writing a book about civil rights. And he was calling me to interview me, and I was interviewing him. He didn't know that. And at the end of our discussion, I said, would you be willing to represent me? I want to sue the Board of Education. And he said, yes. Now, sometimes I say that the stars were aligned around this court case because we had an amazing judge. The first African-American female federal judge, Constance Baker Motley. And she knew discrimination when she saw it. So she strongly encouraged the Board of Ed to give me another medical exam, which they did. And then I got my license. And while it took a number of months for me to actually get a principal to offer me a job, I finally did get a job and I started teaching that fall in the same school that I had gone to, second grade. So that's a whole other TED talk. But I was learning, as my friends were, and people I didn't know around the country, that we had to be our own advocates, that we needed to fight back people's view that if you had a disability, you needed to be cured, that equality was not part of the equation. And we were learning from the civil rights movement and from the women's rights movement. We were learning from them about their activism and their ability to come together, not only to discuss problems, but to discuss solutions. And what was born is what we call today the disability rights movement. So I'd like to tell you a couple of riddles. How many people do you think it takes to stop traffic on Madison Avenue during rush hour in New York City? Have a guess? How many? 50. One would be too little. 50 people. And there were no accessible paddy wagons, so they had to just kind of deal with us. But let me tell you another riddle. How many people does it take to stop a bus in New York City when they refuse to let you on because you're in a wheelchair? One. That is the right answer. So what you have to do, though, is take your wheelchair, sidle in the right place, right in front of the steps, and give it a little push underneath, and then their bus can't move. any of you who want to learn how to do that, talk to me after this. In 1972, President Nixon vetoed the Rehabilitation Act. We protested, he signed it. Then the regulations that needed to be promulgated to implement that law had not in fact been signed. We demonstrated, they were signed. And when the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, our Emancipation Proclamation Act, looked as though it might not in fact be passed in the House or Senate, disabled people from all across the United States came together and they crawled up the Capitol steps. That was an amazing day. And the House and Senate passed the ADA. And then President Bush signed the ADA. It's a great picture. President Bush signed the ADA on the lawn of the White House. It was an amazing day. And there were about 2,000 people there. It was July 26, 1990. And one of the most famous statements he had in his speech was, "Let the shameful walls of exclusion finally come tumbling down." For any of you in the room who are 50 or older, or maybe even 40 or older, you remember a time when there were no ramps on the streets, when buses were not accessible, when trains were not accessible, where there were no wheelchair accessible bathrooms and shopping malls, where you certainly did not have a sign language interpreter or captioning or braille or other kinds of supports. These things have changed and they have inspired the world. And disabled people around the world want laws like we have, and they want those laws enforced. And so what we've seen is something called the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. It is a treaty that was adopted in 2006. It's celebrating its 10th year anniversary. More than 165 countries have joined this treaty. It is the first international human rights treaty fully focused on disabled people. But I am sad to say that our U.S. Senate has failed to recommend to our president that we ratify the treaty. We signed it in 2009, but it doesn't come into force until ratification. And the president, no president, can ratify a treaty without the consent of the Senate. So we feel really strongly that our U.S. Senate needs to do its job, that our Senate needs to enable us as Americans not only to be able to assist disabled people and governments around the world to learn about the good work that we've been doing, but it's equally important that disabled people have the same opportunities to travel, study, and work abroad as anyone else in our country. And as long as many countries don't have the same laws as we do, and don't enforce them if they have them, opportunities for disabled people are more limited. When I travel abroad, I'm always meeting with disabled women. And those women tell me stories about how they experience violence and rape, and how in many cases, these forms of violence occur from family members and people that they know. People that they know, who in fact may be working for them. And frequently, these cases are not adjudicated. I meet disabled people who have been offered jobs by businesses because they live in a country where there's a quota system. And in order to avoid a fine, they will hire you and then tell you, you don't need to come to work because we really don't need you in the facility. I have visited institutions where the stench of urine is so strong that before you open the door of your vehicle, you're kind of pushed back. And then gone into those institutions where people should be living in the community with appropriate supports and seeing people almost naked, people who are chemically drugged, and people who are living lives of despair. These are some of the things that the U.S. needs to be doing more to correct. We know discrimination when we see it, and we need to be fighting it together. So what is it that we can be doing together? I encourage you all to recognize that disability is a family you can join at any point in your life. I'd like to see by a show of hands, how many of you have ever broken a bone? And then I'd like, when you leave today, to maybe write a couple of sentences about what that period of time has been like for you. Because frequently I hear from people, you know, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that. People talk to me differently, they acted differently towards me. And that's what I see and other disabled people see in flashing letters. But we, you in this room, people listening and watching this TED Talk, together we can make a difference. Together we can speak up for justice. Together we can help change the world. Thank you. I have to go catch my bus.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman
this
Press.
This and other episodes of
Whether
Disability Beater.
For an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM Community Radio for East Central Illinois and streaming online at weft.org. And if you haven't received it yet, if you haven't looked for it, check out the WEFT app. You can find it in the Apple Store and on Google Play. And it allows access to not only everything that's playing over the air on WEFT, but also to archived programs. So if you're a jazz fan, you can go back and listen to hours and hours of jazz that's being held on this archive. Same thing with blues and global music. And we are very, very thrilled to have a way for folks to tune in easily to WEFT, especially those folks that don't necessarily have radios. So check out the app, and if you don't have that, you can always go to our website and stream at weft.org. Stay tuned now for Food Sleuth Radio, and after that, lots of other great programming, including some live local music this evening on WEFT Sessions. So be sure to stick around for that as well. And without further ado, here is today's episode of Food Sleuth Radio.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today, I'm delighted to welcome my guest, Dr. Supatra Tovar. She is a clinical psychologist, a registered dietitian, and author of Deprogramming.